All right, we're in a new section and nobody gave me a box to pack my stuff in. So we're just gonna keep rolling. We did pretty much all of 1 Samuel was what we were studying last time. And this is 2 Samuel is just a continuation. So at the end of 2 Samuel, I'm gonna paraphrase this part just because we'll get into it more here in a second. But it asks us to start with 1 Samuel. What happens in 1 Samuel is Saul goes into battle. Obviously, without God's blessing during that time, David is living in exile. So David's living with the Philistines. And the Philistine king grows a liking to David. Then they go to war in the battle that Saul's killed in with the Israelites. David actually asks, the king of the Philistines says, "Hey, the elders of the people that I listen to don't want you to go into battle with us. They're worried about you." And so even the Philistines kick David out. And so Saul and Israel goes to battle with the Philistines, and that becomes Saul's downfall. He dies, and then we pick up in 2 Samuel. So we are going to read a little bit of 2 Samuel. Starting in chapter 1, this goes over a whole lot of Bible, 5 chapters. So we're going to have to kind of pick and choose here. There's a lot of good stuff. I hope when y'all go home, y'all at least read through the whole section that it talks about, because there's going to be some stuff that we're not going to get to talk about because of time constraints. But we are going to talk. I'm going to point out a couple things that stand out to me. Your book goes over a little bit of that. And so we're going to start in 2 Samuel chapter 1. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell on the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on a spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." Then David, and this is one of the things that I want to point out. Think about David's past. David's at least 2 opportunities to take Saul's life into his own hand, and instead he continues with a godly portion of patience. He doesn't take the opportunities to kill Saul, even though we've all talked about and said that it would be justifiable, a man who is seeking your life, to retaliate. In both instances, David refrains from taking him, and his stance is, "Who am I to lay a hand against God's anointed?" And we talked about David already knows he's not king yet. He's living amongst the Philistines as an exile, and his stance is still, he knows he's God's anointed, and he's letting things play out in God's time. Then David took a chance, yeah. Then David took a hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him, and they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan, his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I am a son of a sojourner and a Amalekite." David said to him, "How is it you are not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" I think we probably have mixed feelings about that, don't we? Saul, in a moment of battle, he's on a spear and he looks like he's not going to make it. And what does this guy do? What Saul the king asks him to, right? And what I hope is portrayed in this passage, in this instance. David doesn't lay a hand against him because he is God's anointed. And he says, "That's not my place." Now he's asking somebody who is a sojourner in God's land, who probably has been talked about, knows and understands God to a varying degree, but more than likely to a similar degree as the Israelites. They've lived there. They lived amongst the people. This was probably the best place on the planet to sojourn, right? Because God's calling is high to how they're to treat the sojourners. So they were probably accepted. They were probably loved on, taught the ways, and loved being there, to this point that they are in and amongst the battle on Israel's side. And he's standing next to the king. The king asks him to do something, and he does it. And what's David's response? He kills him. I think that's something that we're supposed to wrestle with. I think the Bible does this intentionally, because on the outside looking in, what does it look like? That's kind of messed up, isn't it, David? Like, he's following king's orders. But who's the king? God's the king. And Saul has fallen out of favor, and Saul is in this place of a prince. And this guy who knows and understands God stretches out his hand against God's anointed. After David had many opportunities and didn't, somebody else does it, and David commands him to be struck down. There's a couple ways that you can go with this, and I'm not saying anyone's right. I'm just saying I hope y'all can go home and wrestle with this, because I think that's what we're meant to do. I think we're meant to wrestle with it. Again, I'm not saying this is right, but how many times do we try to hinder or hold up one of our own, one of God's anointed, right? Because after the veil is torn, we're all supposed to be part of the kingdom. We're all supposed to be these reflections of God, this image of a king priest, or a king that is a priest, that we see in Melchizedek. And David kind of gets some of it, and we see these little glimpses of it, is what we're called to be on a day-to-day, right? These priests were somebody who carried the word from God, gave it to the people. We're all sitting here, and that's all what we're called to do, right? And so they've stretched out a hand against God's anointed on a very basic level. How many times do we get frustrated amongst ourselves? Or how many times do we get held up on what we're doing? And we hold up our lives in order to make sure that something's not going perfect for somebody else. Or how many times do we get a little bit jealous, a little bit envious, a little bit contorted when there's good news being passed around, but stuff in my life's not going well? Maybe. Hopefully not. But I've done it. Right? Things are going so poorly in this instance that I'm, when I hear somebody else has this good news, what does it make me think? Well, I could really use some of that right now. Why not me? Right? And I know we're taking this down to the nuts and bolts, but I love instances in the Old Testament when things are just shown in the extremes. Because when you get to the extremes, oftentimes we discount them. Right? I had to do a lot of reading this week, which is good for me because I have the lesson today. And we're going to talk about some extremes. And last week, Kevin talked about some extremes with anger. As, hey, don't even be, not it. Let's go take murder down to anger. If you're angry, then you'd be judged by the council, right? If you call somebody a moron, then you're going to get tossed into the pits of hell, right? That we take these extremes, these hyperbolic statements, and oftentimes in our head, what do? We discount it. We take it, we kind of push it off, and we're like, nah, like, that's pretty crazy, right? We're about to go into a passage that says, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Is that not pretty extreme? But right after it says, better to lose your right hand and your right eye than to be tossed in the pits of hell. And I think we can all agree on that. So we diminish some of the value that gets, because this, again, I hope when y'all take it out from here, y'all wrestle with it in your own ways. But these passages weren't meant to be glossed over. They're meant to be struggled with. And I think that's important that we struggle with them. Because anytime there's something in the Bible that makes you question if it was the right decision, but there's not a condemnation, should probably spark some study time. Right? I mean, we've talked about this over and over when we were talking about Achan.
I think it's still on the board.
And he steals gold when God told him not that everything was to be devoted to destruction or devoted to God's house. And what does he do? He takes something. And then what happens to Achan? He gets stoned and his whole family gets burned. And we're sitting on the outside going, pull. I'm not sure about that, right? I mean, that's pretty harsh. And when he gets pulled into the when they cast lots and they single him out, he gets pulled in, and what does he say? Forgive me. Like, I was wrong. Right? And what happens? He still gets stoned and his whole family gets burned. And we're thinking, what on earth? It's because oftentimes we take this, the goodness and the grace and the mercy, and we try to overlap it without wanting to see the other side of God, without wanting to see the judgment side. If our books talked about it, and when we were, I think this was in the first 10 lessons, that there's a perspective out there that is, well, if God is good and God is merciful, then everybody will be saved. Missing the point, isn't it? What I've stood up here and I've said a lot is God is a relational God. Though we don't deserve it, he's relational. But what does relationship involve? Both parties. Right? It's not considered a relationship if one party takes something into their own hands. Then they go to prison, right? So that's not a relationship by our law, by old law, by anything. We're going to keep reading a little bit. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan, his son, and he said, it should be taught on the people of Judah. Behold, it is written in the book of Jashar, He said, "Your glory, O Israel, is slain in your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. Your mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields or of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty. The bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Your daughters of Israel weep over Saul, who clothed you in luxurious scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen. In the midst of the battle, Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished." Would you write a poem about somebody who continually tried to kill you like that? Right? This is what I'm talking about. David, again, somebody after God's own heart, which has his shortcomings, and I'm sure we will get to him, right? But a man after God's own heart recognizes God's anointed, who's tried to kill him for years and years, and not only tried to kill him, but went out of his way to pursue him to kill him, right? And this is how he honors him. I probably would have left him out of the poem, right? I probably would have just left it at Jonathan. Jonathan helped me escape. Jonathan had my back. Jonathan was a brother. Saul, not so much, right? This is what I'm saying. I hope that we can get our minds around the people in God's family, or this is, I mean, definition of love somebody as yourself. This is definition of love a neighbor. This is definition of love your enemies, right? He takes this, and this is summed up in one poem. David has two opportunities to kill him. He doesn't do it. Goes into battle, gets slain. What does he do? He weeps, he mourns, he writes a poem. Not diminishing what Saul's done, but this is the best thing we've ever heard about Saul, right? This is, not only is this not diminishing to him, this is exalting him, putting him on a high place, saying, "Blessed is he who clothed the women in scarlet." Blessed, I mean, this is portraying him as something that we haven't read about in the last few books, right? Because we probably, in our heads, are starting to get this bad picture of Saul. And he chooses to portray the good. He chooses to stand on the line that he's God's chosen and he was anointed. That's a pretty powerful testament in and of itself. Go ahead. Right? Because at this point, I'm not sure David knows, but he knows he's the anointed one. At this point, Saul's out of the way, so I'd probably be high-fiving, right? I'm going to be a king, right? It's the Lion King. Simba's singing, "I just can't wait to be king," right? He's about to get put in this spot, and what does he do? He mourns. He's sorrowful. He tears his clothes. I mean, this is the opposite of what you'd expect, getting news that somebody killed somebody that's been trying to kill you for years. That you've been so, not necessarily afraid from, because I'm not sure that that's the word, but you've almost, to David's almost wanting to kind of save Saul from himself, right? He keeps pursuing. God keeps giving Saul into his hand. And so he could have stayed and been like, "Hey, third time's the charm. Let's kind of tease him out here, bait him out, and then I'll get him next time." Because after three times, it's super justifiable, right? No, he flees. Not commanded to flee, he flees to enemy territory. And have you ever met the guy that things just kind of work out for? It's kind of David right now, right? He flees into enemy territory, and the Philistine king loves him, right? He's like, man, this guy's a stench to his own people, because David keeps bringing reports that he raided Benjamin and Gad and all these places, and he's beloved by them and by Israel. This is the same Israel that's singing, Saul's killed his thousands, David's killed his 10,000s. I mean, in that moment, he had all the momentum. We're probably rooting for a coup, right? Like, hey, David, everybody's singing your praises. Like, it's time to take over. What does he do? He just works for Saul, right? What does Saul do? Continually puts him in harm's way to try to kill him. What does David keep doing? He keeps winning battles for Saul. And so we have this foreshadowing, right? Saul keeps putting David in a bad spot. David puts Bathsheba's husband in a bad spot the same way Saul did to him. But we'll get to that later. Go ahead. Right. Yeah. Don't speak poorly on him. But that's with anything, right? That's with dead or alive. That's with the whole bit is, I think we can become so lax in, I think we can just brush over it, and we can talk incredibly poorly about people. I mean, and that's just becomes, for a lot of people, habitual. I mean, there's people that I don't much like having a conversation with because it's always the bad, right? It's like, come on, get a little bit of sunshine in your life and let's move on. There's those people, and it becomes habitual. And I think this is, again, one of the most extreme examples, but a great example of what we're called to do is not to talk poorly, it's not to talk down, it's not to hold somebody down, it's not to take away from your life so that you can take away from somebody else's life. David's over and over trying to add to Saul's life. What happens when Saul pursues after him and David and another guy sneak into Saul's camp? And the other guy's like, hey, let me pin him to the ground with a spear. It's right next to his head. Let me finish this. David says no. Then do you remember? David has some strong words for the guy who's supposed to be protecting Saul. He says, hey, you're failing at your job. How did two guys sneak into camp and get right next to the king's head with the king's spear? Then after that, he leaves. Again, not out of pushed away. I mean, over and over, Saul's been put into his hands. He could continue down that path. I truly believe that he's left for the sole purpose of saving Saul. It's not explicitly said, but it, in the context of everything we're reading, it's, I mean, why not? Everybody in this instance knows that God is on David's side. And when God's on your side, again, if God's with you, who can be against you? Saul's coming against him several times. God gives him right into his hand. I think Saul's exiting himself, or David's putting himself out of the situation for Saul to do something poor. Which, again, to us is mind-blowing because we're like, hey, one misstep, David could be king, right? You're not getting any younger, David. Let's go. And he continually chooses patience. He continually chooses God's plan. Go ahead. Yes, and I mean, it's evident, so evident that, and that's not to say we're not going to die or not going to, right? That's to say that when God has a plan, what happens? It happens. God's plan happens. God has anointed David, said, you're going to be the next king. What does it say? Does it say the guy that was supposed to be protecting Saul just fell asleep? Said God caused a deep sleep on the camp. I mean, this is God's work. This is God's doing. And again, David takes all these little opportunities where he could very easily divide a kingdom or tear it down or start a coup, because he's got these men who are obviously incredibly loyal to David, not to Saul, that have won many, many battles, that are men of valor, got them all around them telling them, hey, just finish it. Hey, just finish it. Hey, just finish it. Nana talked to me about that after I said that a week or two ago. It's like, you know the amount of peer pressure David voided off in those instances? Not only peer pressure, but this is, again, an evidence of, and y'all are getting some of the sermon today too, and I think that's probably just because it's so prevalent in my mind. This is such a show of an overflow of the heart, right? Because if you're not overflowing with God, something's overflowing. How easy is it going to be to fall into peer pressure, right? If you're not wholeheartedly in tune with what God's plan is, all you know is, hey, I'm to be the next king. And you walk into these several situations where David could have had Saul's life. What do? You take it. I already know I'm the next king. To everybody, this is justifiable. Everybody but God, right? And we're going to see this again. I talked for a long time. You can give me a hard time, Caleb. But we're going to kind of skip over this. Second chapter, David is anointed king. He comes down, he's anointed king, but only over part of the kingdom. Only over Judah. So he's anointed over Judah, and the rest of Israel is following Saul's son. And so somebody takes it upon himself to prop up Saul's son as the king, and again, David's patience, David's comfort and connectedness with God prevails, because, again, he's got a stance, right? He knows he's God's anointed. He also has a vow with Saul that he's not going to destroy the rest of Saul's line. He's got to deal with them. What does he do? He holds to his word. So Saul's son becomes king. It's going to talk a lot about a lot of stuff. You get introduced to Abner and Joab. These are kind of the right-hand men. Of Saul's son and of David. And then in chapter 3, Abner, which is on the opposition to David, comes and says, hey, let me, I actually do want to read some of that. Then Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, to whom does this land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you. And he said, good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you is that you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter. When you have come to see my face, then David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid bridal price, and of 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband Paltiel, the son of Laish. Wanted to bring that up because Abner is starting to make a deal, and what does Abner say? To who does this land belong? Right? Again, he's been on the opposition for years. To who does this land belong? He's understanding, he's conceding that, hey, this is your land. Here's where I want to get to. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and then the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go. I will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away and he went in peace. Just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab went to the king and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, and to know your going out and your coming in, and to know all that you are doing. Start spitting in his ear again, right? What does Abner do? He comes, offers peace, says, hey, I'll deliver the rest of Israel into your hand. I have the respect of the people, and we'll unite the kingdoms, right? What does Joab do when he hears about it? Not so happy about it. So Joab proceeds. Oh, he's going to buzz me. You rascal. All right. Paraphrase time. So Joab goes out when he's with his men. Joab brings men and kills Abner, murders him. David hears about it, and David puts this curse on Joab and his family, saying that there will never be a time where Joab's family is not either affected by leprosy, boils, or war. Pretty tough thing to hear, right? Leprous or who holds spindle or who falls by the sword or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, like Abner, because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. And then David then said to Joab and all the people who were with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David followed the bier. They buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept, and the king lamented for Abner, saying, should Abner die as fools die? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen. And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day, but David swore, saying, God, do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner, the son of Ner. Isn't it amazing? Just by his actions, just by what David does, how it unites a people. Isn't it amazing that he doesn't go to defense of himself, how his actions defend himself? Isn't it amazing that he doesn't get put to trial and say, did you do this right? Because on the outside looking in, could be, right? He came to offer a peace deal, say he's going to deliver the rest of Israel into his hands, and then he leaves, and his right-hand man who leads his army goes out and strikes him down. Doesn't look so good, right? But by his actions, by who he is and who he shows himself to be, unites a people, right? Because the other side could be very upset about this. So what do? They watch. This isn't something that says, and everybody was understood that they had a new sheriff in town because he came and took it by force. No, it says they watched him, they observed him. They watched him weep. They watched him weep because he wouldn't eat, because he was mournful of Abner. They watched him lament over him. And then they understood that he wasn't the one to blame. And everything the king did pleased the people. I have loved reading about David. obviously, we get into at least one Rocky story, right, to come. But I hope y'all take a little more time than we have to go through it, because he is an incredible example. I do want to read the memory verse before we go. Psalms 32:5. I acknowledged my sin to you, and I did not cover my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. That sounds very New Testament, doesn't it? I hope we can keep that congruent as we read it. David is an amazing reflector. As I've said before, oftentimes we tend to put some of these characters on a pedestal, and it's hard not to do that with David. But it is incredibly neat to think about that however much respect you have in David and all of his actions, his patience, his intertwined thoughts with God, however much respect you have for him, understand that something still had to come after him, and that was Christ, because not even David could perfect the law, could perfect what we needed out of a Savior. And so I like the story of David. He shows some great qualities, but how amazing is it to think about that? We read this and we have so much respect, and you see the respect that David carries from his people, and to know that somebody much greater than him was to come. And that's who we get to worship. So thank y'all for being here. Don't be afraid to fire me mid. Whenever y'all need to drop the hammer, just drop it. But thank y'all for being here. Next week, some more David, and we'll get into it, and that'll be exciting.